Thanks for the invitation. Wonderful to be here. Andreas, you're 60. How did it happen? Yeah, you didn't do anything, it just happened. You just, you know. Right, so very nice to be here on this wonderful occasion. All the best. And it's, I must say, also very nice as a byproduct to see all my friends in Toronto again. So I'm going to talk about the work I've been doing in applied logic. So this is the work that deals with applying formal or symbolic methods of analysis of computer protocols. And in particular, this is the work that I've been doing for a couple of years with the students on the analysis of Kerberos 5 authentication protocol. If you're part of a university or a large organization and you're logging in, chances are you're using this protocol. Okay, so let me first tell you very briefly what the talk is going to be about, and then I'll get back and into the details. Okay, so this is a part of several years of work, and what I'm going to show you is the payoff after about 5 years of this. Kerberos is what they call a protocol suite, so it has various parts. We'll be focusing on something called PKInit, which is a public key version. And in this particular part of our analysis, we actually found a real attack, real flaw in the PKInit specification when using the so-called public key mode, which is one of the two possible modes. I'll tell you a little bit. And this is an actual attack. It prevents what the protocol is trying to do. It prevents full authentication and confidentiality of the users. And to make matters more interesting, this flaw in the protocol spec has been inherited for so many versions that in the meantime it actually got implemented. And it got implemented in Windows 2K, Windows XP, Windows 2003. So actually what happened was that at the end, there was a security patch that came out that all of you using Windows probably downloaded on August the 9th, 2005. It was one of ours. So what is this? It's not a problem with cryptography. I'm not going to talk about crypto. In this attack, crypto is working fine. This is not a problem with implementation. Implementation is working fine. There's not a problem with infrastructure, the usual internet, underlying internet exchanges such as TCP, IP, packets, working, everything is working fine. Nevertheless, there is a problem. Where is the problem? The problem is higher up. It's on the structural, or if you wish, a logical level. So what will happen as a result of the attack is that the server, so there are two parties, server and the client, and the server will believe that he's talking to the attacker, and client will believe she's talking to the server, and the attacker will know the key that's supposed to be shared by the client and the Kerberos server, so later on, everything will be open for the attacker. I will get to the more refined analysis later, but it had to do with the flaw had to do with particular features of digital signatures, and we'll see how this happens in a minute. We also then participated in work of the Kerberos Working Group, which is part of the something called Internet Engineering Task Force, IETF. And that's an international body with the voluntary participation. There are these committees that write protocol specifications. It's an ongoing process. And we then contributed to the wording of the rewriting. I don't mean to say that this was just a problem with Windows software. Since the problem appears on such a basic logical level, it was also implemented in Linux and other places where the protocol is implemented. So in addition to interacting with IETF, and they were interested in fixing the problem and coming up with a correction, we also subsequently had a lot of interaction with a body called CERT, To us, oddly enough, they were interested in old versions. They are in forensics. So the question was, which of the old versions were affected by this? Now, why would anybody know? Why would anybody want to know this? Well, because people are conservative. And when they implement things, they implement older versions of something and not necessarily the most up-to-date versions. So in a situation like this, you want to know, and the public needs to know, which of the old versions are actually affected by the problem. And so we help trace the problem backward. All right, so now let's get into detail. Okay, so the goal of the protocol, first of all, Kerberos is intentional misspelling of the mythical creature from Greek mythology. That was, I think, the last of the Hercules' labors to subdue this multi-headed beast who is guarding the entrance to the Hades. It's actually a beautiful story. They fought and fought and fought, and during the course of this ferocious fight, Hercules came to love the animal, and then at the end of the fight, when Hercules won, he spared the life of the beast. It's got a very beautiful story. The goal is to repeatedly authenticate a client to multiple servers on a single logon. Okay, it's used all over the place. You want a remote login, file access, printing, anything. And as I already mentioned, it's part of Windows, Linux, Unix, and you name it. Cable TV boxes use it. It's part of the standardization process and ongoing extension and refinement by the Internet Engineering Task Force. The current version for Kerberos itself is something called RFC, with a number. RFC stands for, innocuous phrase, request for comment. What this is a long English document, which is an official spec produced by IETF of a protocol under consideration. And in spite of this innocuous name, request for comment, it's actually supposed to be an official version. So what happened to in our case was that we made a contribution just before PKINIT reached that level of maturity to become request for comment. So it was actually quite fortuitous for everyone. We got credit for finding a real-world bug, and the IETF was able to change the specs and correct it before it became official. Okay. So now, in abstract, what is Kerberos? And by the way, it's misleading when I just say what is Kerberos. In fact, most of the work went into coming up with a slide like this. In other words, most of the work goes on in taking this raw English document with chapters and subchapters and pages in it, and having a precise enough but still applicable enough mathematical formalism that allows one to, number one, see the forest, make an analysis of the forest. But number two, it's precise enough and low level enough so that we can also talk about the trees. And it's the interaction of these two levels that analysis happens. So, if you ask me now, what did we actually do? As well, we found this appropriate level of abstraction at which we could describe the protocol precisely and mathematically, exactly. Now, taking that contribution, then basically any of the number of formalisms that exist for protocol analysis could be used. Any number of the automated tools could be used to find the same mistake. But the contribution is really in making this kind of abstract and clear and exact digest of the protocol. So there are three rounds. The idea of the original version is that client is going to use the most prized possession, namely its secret key, okay, which has previously been registered and has been approved, etc. And this the client it wants eventually get access to some server S, but in order to do that, it has to go through several rounds. And in the first round, it's going to use its secret key to talk to Kerberos authentication server K and request to get access to something called TGS, which is ticket granting server, which may or may not be a separate entity from this, that's a detail. And what KAS will give it in response is something called a ticket granting ticket. And something called an authenticator. Notation here is that braces are encryption. In this case, encryption with the symmetric shared secret key between C and K. So that's the very expensive assumption that such a thing exists. Okay. Now, the beauty of the Kerberos protocol is that from that point on, this KC is not used at all. And you get this multi-level security out of this, is that from that point on, round two is going to be interaction between C and T, basically of the similar nature as round one, but it's going to use only the key that KAS produced for the communication between C and TGS. And then in response, TGS is going to send the service ticket. And then with that service ticket, client is going to get access to the printer down the hall in the hotel room, whatever. Now, TGT is the ticket granting ticket produced by KAS in round one, and service ticket is a similar kind of object produced by TGS in round two. And as you can see, the TGT is encrypted with KT, which is the key, that secret key that's shared between K and T, and KS is a secret key that's shared between T and F. So these tickets are encrypted. They are not readable by C. C doesn't really know what's in these tickets. Okay, so now why public key Kerberos? So as you saw on the previous slide, public key Kerberos is intended as a public key replacement for round one. Why? Well, because that assumption that there is a shared secret key between a client and the server is very expensive. It's people really are trying to replace this by using so-called public key infrastructure, and this may be a little more accepted in Europe than on this continent, but I think the trend is now even here in large organizations that you're going to be getting maybe your university ID card soon will actually be a smart card. You're going to have your public key on it, and that's how you'll be growing access to it. Originally, interestingly enough, this change from symmetric cryptography to public cryptography was motivated by security, and there is something to that. You know, that secret key that's shared between client and the server is, what do people do? You come up with some password. But the passwords that people come up with have very, very low entropy. I mean, that's just a fact. And so the level of security based on those keys that people make up is not so high. It's much better, mathematically much better, if it's a public key produced by some PKI that's given to you on a smart card that you have to use properly. If you look at the current version of the document, this has disappeared. And the current emphasis for the motivation is on functionality. All right, so now this extension is called PKInit for the public key initial phase of Kerberos. And the current version, after our contributions eventually and further discussions, it became an RFC, and now it is called RFC 4556. We had found an attack in version 25. Subsequently, there was a version 26 that consisted of some other changes and not yet addressed the issue here. And then version 27 was the first version that reflected our concerns. Okay, so there are two modes. One is so-called public key mode, and the other is the Diffie-Hellman mode. And our attack is against the public key mode. I will say very little today about Diffie-Hellman mode, except that it appears that our attack does not work in this case. Okay, so this is now getting maybe a little more detailed. So rounds 2 and 3 are still the same as they were before. And that's part of the problem is that the flaw that we found in round 1 is of such nature that rounds 2 and 3 do not catch it. So they're just perpetuated. So now, here is round 1. And that is this one round is PKNet. You see how fun this protocol analysis business is, okay? They're just two things, two messages, okay? They have one request from client to server and one response, okay? What can go wrong, right? But look again. Braces denote digital signatures. Square brackets denote digital signatures. Double braces denote public key encryption. Single braces denote symmetric key encryption. So there's actually in these two lines, the kitchen sink is in there. I mean, all the elements of modern cryptography are in this protocol. So if you have an analysis method you claim to have some successful thing, this is the thing, the kind of thing that one should really try to, try a method on. And that's what we did. So what's the problem? The problem is that there is no shared secret key. And somehow, K still has to produce this new secret key that's going to be intended for use between the client and the TGS. So how is this going to happen? I mean, it should be sent back securely, so it has to be encrypted by something. Well, I mean, some information will be encrypted by C's public key that only C can decrypt, right? But then all this other information has to be encrypted by... So key has to make up a new key. And then, of course, key also has to send this key to C in some way to allow C to look at the appropriate information. Okay, so that's what's happening. So in the response, KAS is actually producing two new keys, this temporary key K, and then KCT that's intended for further use between C and T. Okay, so how does K answer? So the request consists of a timestamp, a freshly chosen number, and the terminology, this is called a nonce. This is to prevent replay attacks or to have some kind of registration number for this particular exchange. This is a list of certificates that are produced by another protocol, and that's part of the public key infrastructure, that's intended to prove that C is a legal user. This is a signature that C makes on TC and N2 to enhance integrity of this message to make sure that nobody tampers with this. And C's name, T's name, and another nonce, again, to identify this particular exchange. Now, in response, what K is doing is sending back something encrypted with C's public key. So the intention here is only C will be able to see that. What's inside? The payload consists of K's proof of identity, this temporary freshly chosen key, the same nonce that K got, a signature over that, signature by K over this, C's name, the intended address C, and then basically the same kind of material as K had sent in the original version of Kerberos, namely the ticket-granting ticket and the authenticator, which C will be able to decrypt and then will be able to use this K for further communication with T. Okay, so I actually talked about the formalizational reply. Okay, and now what is the attack? So as I mentioned, this is not a problem with crypto implementation. This is a structural attack. Okay, and it's possible because the Kerber server did not sign the data that identified the client. It signed K and N2, so the payload is the fresh key, and together with the N2, but the name of the addressee of the message, C, was left unsigned. And that opens the door for another legal user to be the attacker. Okay? So the threshold for our attack is that an attack can be mounted only by another party that's a legal user in the system, which is bad enough. Okay? So our Kerberos server signs some data from client and sends them in reply to the attacker, and then the attacker will just forward this to client after learning keys. Now, I regularly talk to various friends in the crypto community, and I was talking to Rand Kennedy at the time, who had a lot of experience with other protocols such as Internet Key Exchange. And in particular, he said, well, I remember some way, way back in some early versions of so-called IKE, Internet Key Exchange Protocol, there was some kind of problem with station-to-station protocol, which was the original, one of the early versions of Internet Key Exchange, that had some problems with identity misbinding. So, and this indeed is the kind of problem that we found here. So this is not a new type of attack. It's been known as an attack on a signature basically since 1993, when it was mounted by Diffie, Van Oorschot, and Weiner against the station-to-station protocol, and a very similar attack, not against the signatures, but against public encryption by Gavin Lowe, which was an anomaly in the Needham-Schroeder public key protocol. So the version 27 was intended to defend against this attack, and we contributed to the formulation. Okay, so here is the attack in detail. Okay, so everything happens by the book, okay? So at time PC, the client sees requests a ticket for ticket server T using nonsense N1 and N2, okay? Just sends a legal format, and the intruder is just like anybody else, seeing all the traffic. And it was going to read this, and now the intruder can, well, you see, the C was sent in plain text. So the intruder can replace the C by its own identity, and it can replace certificates of identity of C by its own certificates of identity. And now it still looks like a legal request. K now thinks that it's I that's trying to contact it. And K will dutifully reply to I with the specified format. Okay? Now, I gets this back and then changes its name back to C. It can decrypt this part because this was encrypted by its public key. And then you'll see the payload. So bad, right? The little K has been revealed. It will see the payload, and then we'll just simply re-encrypt it with C's public key. Okay. Now C is in the meantime waiting there. Says I sent that request to K, and here is something coming back. Well, you know, my nonsense too is in there. You know, other things that must be the request to the message I sent. Okay. It's again a completely legal format message, but I have learned the keys that were intended to be for the use of C and K only. C receives K's signature, assumes that everything was fine, but it isn't. Okay? So the consequences are that the attacker knows the keys that C is using, and in particular the attacker may imperson its servers in later rounds for the client C, and may monitor C's communication with the other end server. So it's bad. Okay, and as I already mentioned, the rest of the Kerberos protocol does not catch this. So now, what property went wrong. Okay, so so this is part of the analysis. Okay, so we formulate the Kurth property, and this is the following authentication property, that if a client C processes a message containing the server-generated, the Kerberos authentication server-generated public key credentials, then some KAS must have produced a set of such credentials for C, and not for somebody else. The attack shows that this property does not hold in PKNet 25 and 26. Now, how to fix it? Okay? So, this whole story is kind of an interesting, if you wish, ethnographic experience for us, right? So, our first reaction was, well, okay, so just put that address in the signature. Okay? So the KAS should sign not just K and N2, but it should sign K and C and N2. Well, more precisely, maybe some function F of C and N2 that is collision-free in some feasible probabilistic sense. Okay? And we shared this with the people who write the code, and they said, no, that's too complicated. I said, what do you mean it's too complicated? It's the simplest thing you can do. And this is the interesting part of this experience. The reason it's too complicated, this fix, which is the first fix that comes up to theoreticians, is too complicated for the code writer, is that, where is he going to find that C? It's somewhere deep inside that request. Okay, so he has to parse, he has to write code to parse this request, and then he has to put it in something. So the code writer said, no. What we're going to do is we're going to take the entire request and then put some checksum on it. And then we're going to sign that in response instead of signing K and N2. Okay? So, what is simpler is an interesting discussion, between theoretician and the code writer. So that's what was eventually, as a result of the discussions, was agreed to be a PKNet 27. Okay? And then another interesting tidbit of this whole experience is that then, of course, the code people who write code wanted to know, well, is this fix correct? And our methodology, we are logicians, right? We have our inductions, double inductions, lemmas, propositions. And we have carefully worked out this, right? And that's what our experience is. And now we have to import this entire methodology into this, okay? And I remember one particular Friday, there was cell phones were used a lot as opposed to email. So the person is asking me, is it correct? So then I send the encrypted email to my collaborators and says, what do you think, guys? Are we there? And then, of course, we had this conference, quick conference. They said, well, we haven't quite proved this proposition. So I call back the code writers and I tell them, yes, it seems it's going to work out, but, there are propositions and lemmas. And he said, look, my production deadline is at 3 p.m. today. Is it right or not? Okay. So that's interesting part of the experience. And academicians like us, took many months to write the paper and put in the conference, etc. And Microsoft had the fix done and approved and gone through the entire software production cycle and testing in 3 months. So I'm not very well experienced in these things, but in this one instance, I actually saw what was under the hood. And it was really very satisfying to see how this can be turned around so quickly. So I will now say a few things about the ideas of fixing this and, of course, our subsequent work on formal proofs of correctness. All right, so we found a bug. Now, people are asking us, how do you fix it? Then there was this give and take of how to fix it, and now prove that the fixed version is correct. Okay, so this is the other half of the contribution. Okay, now, so far, basically, what you see on the slide is what you get. This is just a term algebra. It's a formal language, and the protocol works basically by symbolic rewriting of the formats that you saw on the on the page. And if you see that the several papers on the subject, it's called multiset rewriting. It's based on so-called multiset or concurrent rewriting, etc. So basically, everything happens on this formal level. Nothing is really interpreted. So that's what in the community is called a symbolic model or the Dolezal model. Of course, what you eventually want to know is that if you actually interpret these terms in the first-order language as the actual probabilistic encryption, actual digital signature, actual symmetric encryption, as mandated by various other RFCs that this RFC calls, then the entire product is still correct in some probabilistic sense, presumably up to some standard cryptographic benchmarks. And that second point of view is called the computational model. So basically now the problem becomes what should be more familiar in logicians is you have two models. One is this, one is the formal term algebra, formal language, and another one is a model. In this case, it involves a lot of complexity theory, probabilities, etc. But now what you have to show is that the kind of thing that you prove in the symbolic model is still true after you map it down to this probabilistic computational model. And this general problem is called cryptographic soundness or computational soundness. And that's what I'd like to discuss for the rest of the talk. Okay? So in the symbolic proof or formal proof of guaranteed authentication property, which authentication property? This is the one that I mentioned a couple of slides ago. Okay? We have to make some assumptions. For instance, that the checksum is pre-image resistant. Okay? Well, of course, strictly speaking, there's no such thing. You can't have a hash function that will map arbitrary long strings to strings of some determined length that's going to be one-to-one. Okay? But there are then, of course, ways in cryptographic literature, the standard definitions, that have probabilistic versions of this combined together with the feasible. So it's not feasible to find a collision. Okay? Now, in the term model, in the Dolezal model, there's no such thing. You just make this general assumption. So that's one of the tricky parts, is make sure that this assumption is realized by whatever candidates for checksums you're going to be using in the computational model. Okay, so as you can see from the slide, so, I'll just go through, not to discuss this, but you can see what this really looks like. In the IETF document, you have to deal with code like that. Okay, so it's very far from the picture that I was presenting there. So, IT pack in PKNIT 27. Okay, so after the smoke is cleared and several meetings and discussions, etc., then now the language looks like this. Okay, so again, the main difficulty in doing something like this is taking things of this sort. Okay, see many references to other documents which are also written in this way. Okay, and then making a, if you wish, a logical formalization of this. All right, so here is the corrected version then. The request is still the same as before, and what's being sent back on top level looks the same, but inside here, instead of N2, there's a checksum over the entire request, so this checksum is some keyed hash, etc. Okay, so then first we had the formal proofs in the term model, in the Dolezal model. And then the next round was to come up with cryptographically sound proofs, first by hand, and most recently by a tool. So let me first say a few words of how one does this by hand. So we use the method that was developed by folks at IBM Zurich. Birgit Fitzman and Michael Widener are still there. The young person involved, Michael Backus, subsequently got an academic job in Saarland University and is now a full professor there. What they have is this methodology that deals with the pair of models. One is the Dolevial-like cryptographic library, and the other one is the computational version, or the one that relies on probabilities and computational complexity. And the question is, if you have proved something about the ideal library, a symbolic library, so I should say here, ideal, I prefer to read as symbolic, and real, I prefer to read as computational. Of course, there's nothing actually real about these things. I mean, both are just some mathematical models of what's going on. Okay, one of them happens to use logic, the other one happens to use probability theory, but they're really just models. So what you like to show is that they somehow agree on certain important properties. Okay. Now, the transfer theorem in question requires that the cryptographic primitives used satisfy certain strong cryptographic properties. And here is yet another interesting part of my ethnographic experience. Okay, is that, you know, as a theoretician, I was worried, oh, I'm making some heavy theoretical assumption. This doesn't correspond to the real world. Okay, so I meekly went to the same code writers and I said, yes, well, you see, we do now have, after a few months later, we now do have a cryptographically sound proof. Okay, but unfortunately, we have to use these assumptions. He looks at me and says, of course you have to use some assumptions. So the practitioners weren't concerned about this at all. Okay, so the only question is, you know, does the actual implementation as mandated by the spec, is it consistent with such assumption? And the answer was yes in our case. Okay, so you have to check that much. All right, so then what we end up proving as a result of this transfer theorem is the following probabilistic version of the server client and the authentication. Okay, so if the server completes a protocol run, apparently with client C, then with overwhelming probability, so negligible probability away from one, C must have started the protocol with some KAS and requested the service ticket from some TGS. And furthermore, if a client C completes a protocol run, apparently with S, then with, again, overwhelming probability, S sent a valid reply to C. So this authentication both ways. And overwhelming probability over what? Over the set of runs. Okay, so the set of bad runs is negligible in the full, in the set of all runs. There is an interesting side issue here in that in the Dolevial model, the way the inductive proofs work is that you first have to do, you know, it's a double induction. So one establishes the secrecy property for the key produced at the end of some round, to prove authentication property in the next round, and that that in turn is used to prove the key secrecy. Now, key secrecy in the term algebra is simply, it's a simple thing, that the predicate that says that the intruder knows the key is never reachable in any run of the protocol. Now, what possibly could this mean in the computational model? Okay? And that's where this interesting side story is. I don't want to mention too much about it, but it's interesting. The standard cryptographic definition of key secrecy is very strong. It's very natural in some sense, but it's very strong. It just says that the key is indistinguishable from random by probabilistic polynomial time tests. Okay? So to a feasible adversary, this key is indistinguishable from random. This is a fine definition, except that it doesn't work. There's a very basic kind of, not even dilemma, proposition, is that if a key gets used for encryption, it loses this property. Just even just using the key for encryption sheds certain, you know, mystery, indistinguishability from random. Okay. And so the part of the problem then became, that's a number of people who work on this, not just ourselves, is what appropriately weakened notion of key secrecy should one use in inductive proofs of this kind in the computational model? And I will say a little bit about this. Okay, so currently what we're doing is sort of the third generation of this. All right. So first there was a formal proof of correctness by hand, then computationally sound proof of correctness by hand. Now what we'd like to do is mechanized proof of correctness, which is still computationally sound. And this is kind of an interesting story. I've been working on a formalism that is intended to address questions like this. That's a polynomial time probabilistic process calculus. That's another project of mine that took many years, okay? And it was very complicated, lots of things about soundness and operational semantics that have to be ironed out. Several rounds of students of my collaborator, John Mitchell at Stanford. And I was sure that this is, of course, theoretically very fun, but it's never going to lead to any implementation. Not true. There's a guy, Bruno Blanchet, at École Normale Supérieure in Paris, who was the organizer of the first workshop on the relationship between formal and computational cryptography several years ago. And he also had good graces to implement this calculus. And he has a tool called CryptoVerif, which has been run on standard suite of basic academic protocols, and it behaves quite well. Okay? So our obvious challenge was, let's use Bruno's implementation, which is a dialect of our old calculus, and see if we can run this through a real thing, namely PKNIT, a Kerberos. And this is what we're currently doing. Okay? So the context of this is what I already mentioned a little bit. On one hand, you have this distinction between the symbolic model and the computational model. And on the other hand, you have the distinction between academic protocols and industrial things, okay, such as Kerberos or TLS, Ike, etc. Okay, and originally there had been a lot of work, you know, for almost 10 or 15 years now, on analyzing tools of academic protocols in the symbolic model using model checkers or theorem provers, etc. And more recently, through work of Blanchet, of analyzing academic protocols by mechanized tools in the computational model. But what is happening here, and we're pretty sure this is the first time it has happened, was application of a tool to analyze a commercial protocol in the computational model. So that's a win. So what we're doing is a formalization and analysis of Kerberos 5, both with and without its public key extension, right? So the basic Kerberos and PKNet, using the CryptoVerif tool. So what's happening to my student who is working on this is that he's learning a lot of crypto. Because the tool is so sensitive that it's just not going to come up with proofs until you put in the correct assumptions about the cryptographic primitives you're using. So it's a fun way of actually making students to learn not just the process calculus, but also the crypto behind it. Because he's forever going, I mean, every time something does not get proved, he has to go back and look at the suite of papers and make sure there's just that integrity assumption is formulated properly. Of course, it has to be formulated in the way that this CryptoVerif tool can then crunch on, and that's another interesting thing is to learn the syntax. And then there's this story of how to weaken key secrecy, because the standard notion is just too strong for any kind of protocol that actually uses the key that we are discussing as part of the encryption, as part of the protocol. Okay. What we are doing is we are looking at the notion of, as I'm speaking, you should look at the slides and just get convinced that there's been a lot of previous work, lots of related work. We are looking at the notion, so-called notion, key usability, which is, we think, an appropriate weakening of key secrecy, and key usability was proposed last year by John Mitchell and his group. And it seems to be working quite well with lots of tools. It seems to be working quite well with CryptoVerif and with the standard cryptographic assumptions. So this is part of my student Joe Tsai's, you know, constant reading of papers. We found that we needed exactly this level to make the proofs go through. Just want to walk you very briefly through the kind of properties proved by the. And now with key secrecy properties and key usability properties, so introduced in the 2006 paper in the Computer Security Foundation's workshop by Dada, Derek, Mitchell, and Varinsky, and this really is important for protocols that perform operations with the key during the run. Now, there's a definition of usability is in the paper of theirs, also formulated in a slightly different way in our paper, but let me not walk you through all these details. Running it through the prover, etc., and actually establishing this property as the protocol goes. Okay, so what has happened? We have extended in this particular snippet the formalization of our own formalization of Kerberos 5, and we found a so-called man-in-the-middle attack against a public key encryption mode in PKNet 25 and 26. We had continued to have close collaboration with IETF Working Group, analyzed and proved the fix employed in PKNet 27, and we currently have cryptographically sound security proofs of security properties, both for basic protocol and for the corrected version of the public key, Kerberos, both by hand and most recently in the CryptoVerif tool. First mechanized proofs of authentication and secrecy for full commercial and real-life protocol directly in the computational model. Okay, so what to do next? Well, there's always the issue of really fine-grained cryptanalysis, making sure that you haven't assumed too much, okay? And then checking and double-checking and triple-checking that after all this work and the prover that you have really maintained something that's true to the spec, okay? So just can never get away from this, okay? It's not done. It's not that you read, spend months and months reading the English document and then write some formalism and then you can throw away the English document. No, you have to go back. Every time you revisit this on some more refined level, you have to go back to the English document. The interesting story about Diffie-Hellman mode of PKNet, CryptoVerif cannot, at the moment, deal with the modular exponentiation required in the Diffie-Hellman protocol. So here's an interesting quandary of how to extend the tool, how to extend it to cover the Diffie-Hellman mode. In the meantime, John Mitchell and his group came up with a hand proof of correctness of the Diffie-Hellman mode using their formalism computational protocol composition logic. But there is no, as yet, a mechanized proof. Okay? And now, of course, we shouldn't stop there. There's lots of protocols in the world that come from web services, service-oriented architectures, privacy trust. The methodology that I'm showing you here is applicable all there. So there's an ocean there to be explored. Thank you very much.